Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A historic term. The Supreme Court ends an enormously impactful session with critical rulings on immigration and climate change. Then, high stakes. As the NATO summit comes to a close, a member state bordering Russia weighs in on plans to expand the alliance.
This NATO summit is a green light for preparation in order to be aware of these risks and to deal with this threat adequately.
And fighting the spread. The Biden administration announces plans to distribute more vaccines to counter a rise in monkeypox infections. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The U.S. Supreme Court has wrapped up a term that rewrote the law books on abortion, guns, and today on climate change and migrant asylum policy. That in turn set the stage for a bit more history. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson became the first black woman to serve on the court, sworn in by Justice Stephen Breyer, who today retired. Meanwhile, in Spain, President Biden charged that this court, through its recent anti-abortion ruling, has become a bigger threat to the country than inflation is.
The one thing that has been destabilizing is the outrageous behavior of the Supreme Court of the United States in overruling not only Roe v. Wade, but essentially challenging the right to privacy.
Back now to today's court rulings. Correspondent John Yang is here to unpack the decisions, beginning with West Virginia's win over the EPA.
Judy, in that case, the court said the Clean Air Act does not give the EPA the authority to impose standards intended to shift power utilities from gas and coal fire plants to solar and wind generation. The vote was 6-3, with the conservative justices in the majority and the liberals dissenting. Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. Marcia, what does this decision mean for the EPA's ability to write regulations in the future, not just on climate change, but on anything else?
The court's decision restricts or limits EPA's flexibility to engage in sort of broad-based or systemic approaches to greenhouse gases and its attempt to deal with the problem of climate change. So it's mostly a lack of flexibility and perhaps a warning when it attempts to make other arrangements to go after greenhouse gases that the court's going to be watching closely.
Chief Justice John Roberts wrote this opinion. What was his reasoning?
The Chief Justice said that under this particular provision, what EPA was trying to do was such a national transformational approach to going after greenhouse gas emissions that it required clear authority from Congress to do so. And so in his opinion, he looked for that authority either in the provision itself or in the statute, and said that there was no such authority. And he said that when an agency is going to engage in rulemaking or regulation that has such major significance, economic significance, political significance, other major consequences, that there has to be a clear directive from Congress.
So this could apply to other agencies and rulemaking in other areas?
Absolutely, John, because what the conservative majority did here basically was to adopt a doctrine known as the Major Questions Doctrine. It's a doctrine that's been promoted by businesses and conservative advocates who believe that the federal regulatory state has grown too big and gone too far in regulating public health and safety.
As a matter of fact, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion used the phrase the administrative state.
In fact, the dissent by Justice Kagan accused the majority of an anti of taking an anti-administrative stance here. She said that even though the Chief Justice claimed it was implausible that EPA had this authority without Congress's clear directive, she said it was perfectly plausible because Congress had told EPA to choose the best system. And she repeated that language in the provision. Best system, she said, no ifs, ands, or buts.
And there was another decision today, and the court's final decision of the year. The court ruled for the Biden administration, saying it had the authority to reverse the Trump administration's policy requiring asylum seekers to remain in Mexico while their cases are being considered. Now, in this case, Marcia, we didn't see the ideological breakdown. As a matter of fact, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined the three liberals to create the five-justice majority. What does that tell us about the reasoning, the court's reasoning in this case?
It's not been terribly surprising when the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh have joined with the three liberals on the court to form a majority. I think it really is something that depends on the case, as well as the issue and the arguments that are made. And the government was more convincing here, and so was the statute. The Chief Justice was looking at a provision in the federal immigration law that gave the Secretary of Homeland Security discretion. It said the Secretary may return aliens who enter this country from contiguous countries while it can return them to those countries while awaiting their asylum proceedings. And the Chief Justice said, look, the statute says may return. And he just said may means may, and it doesn't suddenly become mandatory because the administration's violating mandatory detention. And as he pointed out, and as Texas agreed during oral argument, no administration has been able to comply with mandatory detention because Congress has never supplied the department with the resources, the money, or the beds to detain every illegal immigrant that enters our country.
And what did the dissenters in that case say?
Well, Justice Alito wrote the lead dissent, and he said he agreed that the government cannot detain every illegal immigrant that enters the country. But he said it had two alternative choices. It could send them back to Mexico, or it could, under the law, release them into the United States. And he said that the government has chosen to totally ignore the return to Mexico and instead is releasing countless immigrants into this country.
Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal on this final day of this most interesting Supreme Court term. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, John.
And let's look deeper now at the climate change ruling. Many environmental advocates acknowledge today the decision is the EPA, in the EPA case, is a significant blow in the government's efforts to limit greenhouse gases in the near term. As we said, West Virginia won the case after a legal battle over the Clean Power Plan. First, let's hear from the Biden administration. Michael Regan is the EPA administrator. He joins me now from New Orleans. Administrator Regan, thank you very much for joining us. President Biden today said this decision is devastating. How much of a setback is it for your efforts to regulate greenhouse gases?
Well, thank you for having me. And listen, I am deeply disappointed in the Supreme Court's decision today, actually very frustrated. The decision does constrain what we do, but let me be clear, it doesn't take us out of the game. We still will be able to regulate climate pollution, and we're going to use all of the tools in our toolbox to do so. The constraint that we're seeing today just prevents us as a country from making the progress as quickly as we need to. Climate action presents an opportunity for this country to ensure global competitiveness, create jobs, lower costs for families, and protect people's health and well-being, especially those who have suffered from the burden of inaction for far too long. And so, yes, today's action is a disappointing action. It's devastating in many ways, as the president has said, but it doesn't take us out of the game. And we're going to continue to use every tool we have to keep pace with tackling the climate crisis.
Well, the analysts, the experts that we are talking to Administrator Regan are saying, yes, it does give you some options, but every option out there from now on is both more cumbersome and more expensive for the government. So from that standpoint, how much of a setback is this?
Well, you know, we pride ourselves in keeping pace with the growing economy and technological advancements. And so this does constrain the innovation that we could see from the power sector itself. The constraints are on how we can provide the rules of the road for long-term investments by the power sector. But let's be clear, the Supreme Court has also constrained what the power sector would like to do in terms of long-term investments and the utilization of technologies and programs that could be more expansive and more flexible for the industry itself. And so it is a setback, and we will continue to evaluate very thoroughly what the Supreme Court actually has said today. But let's be clear, the constraint does not take EPA out of the game, and we're going to continue to use every tool in our toolbox because it's under our legal authority and it's our obligation to protect communities, reduce pollution that is driving climate change, and provide certainty and transparency for the energy sector to grow the clean energy economy.
Well, can you give us a couple of examples of the kind of tools that you believe you still can use to regulate this industry?
Well, you know, one tool that we'll continue to look at is the authority that was in question with the Supreme Court. Again, that tool is still available. We've just lost some flexibility there. But we also have a suite of regulations that are facing the power sector. And so as we couple the regulation of climate pollution with the regulation of health-based pollution, we are providing the power sector with a very clear picture of what regulations they're facing so that they can make the right investment decisions. And we're hoping that when they look at the regulation of waste and discharges in water, climate pollution, health-based pollution, they'll see that it's not worth investing in the past, and they'll continue to do what they're doing now, which is invest in the future, and that future is a clean energy economy.
Let me ask you also about just the course of what the court has ruled. Now that you are looking at a majority conservative court, how much does that concern you in terms of steps the EPA may take in the future that are most likely to be challenged either by state attorneys general, or others who oppose these efforts by the government to impose some regulation?
You know, it really forces us to contemplate how we move forward as quickly as possible, recognizing that some flexibilities have been taken from us. And so it does impede the progress, but it does not prevent us from continuing to make progress. And so we'll have to be, you know, vigilant in terms of focusing on climate change pollution. We'll also have to continue to do what the president has asked us to do, which is partner with every single cabinet agency and leverage all of the actions as a whole of government. We've got some opportunities ahead of us. This is a setback, deeply disappointing, frustrating to a certain extent. But again, we're going to use every tool in the toolbox that we have to set and implement environmental standards that meet our obligation to protect all people and all communities from environmental harm.
Mr. Administrator, I'm about to talk with the Attorney General for the state of West Virginia, which was instrumental in bringing this case to the Supreme Court. What would you say to him is something that you hope that he and others who brought this case would be willing to look at as a way for the government to make sure that these plants are operating in the cleanest possible way?
You know, I would say that the markets have already spoken. And when you look at the regulation that was in question, that never took place, that the Supreme Court evaluated, the goals of that regulation were met and exceeded years and years ago. And so there's proof that the market is already moving in this direction, and it's our obligation as the government to be able to provide some certainty so that they can make longer-term investments. And so we'll continue to work hard to provide that certainty so that the power sector can continue to make long-term investments in a clean energy economy.
Administrator Michael Regan of the EPA, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And as we said, 19 Republican-led states were a part of the legal challenge to the EPA. Let's turn now to the person I just mentioned. He is West Virginia's Attorney General Patrick Morrisey. He led the national coalition at the Supreme Court. Mr. Attorney General, I don't know if you were able to hear the EPA administrator, but I just want to ask you first, how much of a victory is this today for electric power generation for the power plants in this country?
Look, I think it's a big victory for the rule of law, and I did have the chance to listen to the administrator, and I guess what I would say back is a lot of people are saying tonight the sky is falling, the sky is falling, but people have to take into account that the EPA never had this authority in the first place. There were big promises made over the last decade in terms of what type of initiatives the EPA was going to advance to fight climate change, but we always knew that the EPA only had a narrow sliver of authority to regulate carbon emissions. What I would say to Americans watching tonight is that this decision is not about climate change. It's really about a very simple proposition. Who gets to make the major decisions of the day? Should it be unelected bureaucrats seizing power that has not been delegated to them, or should it be Congress? We've always argued that it's Congress, because that way, whether you're New York or West Virginia or Texas or Nebraska or any of the states across the nation, you're going to have a seat at the table and you're going to have the people's representatives making a choice. And that's what this case is all about. And it's just disappointing to hear a lot of people try to characterize it in some other way. They never had the authority. We knew that from the beginning when we saw the case. I've been working on this since 2013, but it's critical now to understand that so that the debate will likely shift to Congress. But even more importantly, I think people will know now there's a broader tool in place to go after federal overreach whenever it emerges.
Well, what we just heard from Administrator Regan and what we've heard from others is that the authority to regulate is still there. It's just that the amount of flexibility is different. So there, I mean, do you acknowledge that there are still steps that the government can take as necessary for to make sure that the power plant industry, the energy industry broadly, is being careful when it comes to protecting the environment?
Well, most certainly there will be authorities that are available under the Clean Air Act, and that won't change from today. So we've always argued that over the past number of years. In fact, we've argued that the EPA does have a narrow ability to regulate for carbon emissions. But I think folks watching need to understand what this administration has done is they're trying to change the fundamental mission of many of the federal agencies out there. If you're not only the EPA, but you're the HHS, or you're the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Department of Energy, the Department of Labor, the Biden administration is asking everyone to change their mission and become more of an environmental regulator. And that's just not the way our Constitution works. Agencies need to comport with the limits that Congress provides to them. And what we've seen with the Biden administration and others as well, that they have gone so far afield from that statutory authority. I think that's why the court reined them in today. And I think you're going to see more effort to ensure that the Biden administration respects the rule of law, our Constitution, and the separation of powers. This is a big win for the people of America, because now their elected representatives will have a clear voice.
Two other quick points, Mr. Attorney General. And Justice Kagan, in her dissenting opinion today, pointed out, she said Congress has told the EPA, she said, to use the best system of regulation, so that there was direction from the Congress and there was leeway. And there's now been clarification of how much leeway. But in other words, there's still advisory from the Congress to the agency to do the best it can to make sure these emissions are as clean as possible.
Well, look, I think no one is arguing. This is not about having efficiencies or clean air. In fact, everyone supports it. Once again, this is not a case about climate change or hamstring a federal agency. It's about ensuring that when a federal agency acts, it's comporting to the limits that Congress prescribes for them. So the EPA still has certain tools to move forward, but what they don't have the ability to do is on these major questions of the day, for where there's vast economic or political significance, they can't proceed on the basis of maybe some ambiguous language and then try to rewrite the nation's power grid. They can't do that. That's what they tried to do under the Clean Power Plan. And obviously, they've talked about doing things that are not feasible today in terms of trying to have 100 million people on the power grid for electric cars and not only finishing to wipe out coal and get rid of half of natural gas. Some of what they're trying to accomplish, they clearly don't have the legal authority to do. So what I would ask people to do, don't promise your constituents things you can't deliver. Work within the constitutional systems in order to deliver things that are good for the people. And I think that you'll find a lot of folks care deeply, like a lot of West Virginians, about clean air and clean water. But we have to make sure we respect our constitutional system. And that's what today's case stands for.
And I'm sorry, I'm not having time to pose to you the question that the administrator recommended at the end. He said to mention the fact that he hopes you and others realize the markets have already spoken. They want the power industry to move
but
in a clean
Judy,
direction.
The markets responded because the government put a gun to their head and said the regulations are coming to wipe you out. So people forget about that. Government should never possess that kind of power to be abusive. That's why we fought back.
The Attorney General for the state of West Virginia, Mr. Morrissey, thank you very much for joining us. And the Supreme Court's other decision today on the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy is a surprise win for the Biden administration, but it comes with complicated political implications. Laura Barrón-López joins us now to give us a sense of how the White House is reacting to this news. So what are they saying? Laura, what do they think this means going forward?
So what's interesting here is that so far, as of right now, the White House has not put out any official statement. The Department of Homeland Security has not put out an official statement. But this is, my sources have told me, definitely something that's boosted officials within the administration. And it is a clear victory for the White House. It allows them to do away with the Trump-era policy of Remain in Mexico, which President Biden himself called criminal in the past, and Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, in the past also said that it caused unjustifiable human costs. So it's a win for the administration.
So what we have seen is that there were about 70,000 migrants have been held in Mexico since this policy started. How does the administration plan to deal with that?
Right. So for a while, it may not be an immediate effect, which is that the Supreme Court has to send what is called a certified judgment first. And that can take a few weeks before the administration can actually move to start doing away with the policy, to start moving those 70,000 migrants into the U.S. for additional screening. They typically work with NGOs, and what they try to do is to screen them further and then put them into the parole system for immigration proceedings in the United States. So it may take a while. It's going to also take work with organizations on the ground.
And then we know, as you say, a victory for the administration, but there's still this outstanding issue with the so-called Title 42, which came about during the Trump administration. How much of a factor is that in all this?
It still is a big factor, because even with this Remain in Mexico policy being a win, the Supreme Court decision being a win for the administration, there could be additional litigation on that. The administration has tried multiple times to do away with this policy, and the second attempt could come under lawsuits from Texas itself. Now, Title 42 is still out there. It is something that the administration has been forced to keep in place, and as we know, what that does is it requires, it allows the government to immediately expel asylum seekers without any kind of asylum process or them to claim asylum. And there's roughly 1 million that have been expelled under the Biden administration immediately when they're encountered at the border. So far, as I was talking to some Democratic pollsters, for them, it's not really an issue in the midterms right now. It seems to have receded in the public's consciousness because inflation, high gas prices, January 6 hearings are actually more front of mind for Democratic voters. For Republican voters, one thing I found interesting was that during the January 6 hearings this week, RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniels was tweeting about immigration and tweeting about President Biden's, quote, open borders. So that is definitely something that Republicans are going to be hammering going into November.
And has been for some time. But finally, Laura, let me ask you about the big decision from the court that came down last Friday, overturning Roe v. Wade. As we heard at the beginning of the show, President Biden was asked about it, commented again today, very, very critical. You've been reporting on this. What should we expect once the president is back and the administration takes a closer look?
President Biden said two big things today. One, he said that he will be potentially announcing executive actions as early as tomorrow. He's going to be meeting with governors. The second thing was that he said that he was open to a big change in the Senate. Here's what he said.
I believe we have to codify Roe v. Wade in the law, and the way to do that is to make sure the Congress votes to do that. And if the filibuster gets in the way, it's like voting rights, it should be, we provide an exception for this, require an exception to the filibuster for this action.
So he thinks that the Senate should essentially change the filibuster, but the reality is that the votes aren't there right now. And so, again, the administration, President Biden, is saying that this all comes down to whether or not he is able to get additional Democrats into the Senate to see this realized.
Pointing to November elections again.
Again.
Laura Barrón-López, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. In the day's other news, the Supreme Court also opened the door to possibly changing how federal elections are conducted. The justices agreed to consider whether state courts may review election procedures and congressional district lines. The case involves a North Carolina court's ruling against districts that heavily favor Republicans. Judges in Kentucky and Florida became the latest today to block new abortion limits since the end of Roe v. Wade. The ruling in Kentucky halted a near total ban on abortions. A judge in Florida temporarily stopped enforcement of a ban after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The NATO summit has ended with President Biden vowing to defend, quote, every inch of the bloc's eastern flank against Russia. He also pledged another $800 million in arms for Ukraine today. We'll return to the summit after the news summary. Russian forces pulled out of a strategic Black Sea island today, possibly easing pressure on Ukraine's attempts to export grain. Snake Island sits about 90 miles from Odessa. The Russians said it was leaving as a goodwill gesture. Ukraine said that they were driven off. Hong Kong made ready today for the 25th anniversary of its return from British to Chinese rule. Crowds and performers welcomed China's President Xi Jinping. Under his rule, authorities have cracked down on protests and any form of dissent in Hong Kong and barred opposition candidates from elections. Xi praised the changes.
In the past period of time, Hong Kong endured difficult tests one after another, overcame risks and challenges one after another. After the storms, Hong Kong reemerged from the fire and was reborn. Hong Kong is showing vibrance.
This was Xi's first visit to Hong Kong since mass pro-democracy protests there in 2019. In the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the late dictator, was sworn in as president in Manila. He took his oath of office to cheers from supporters 36 years after his father was overthrown. The new president glossed over the widespread corruption and human rights abuses under Marcos Sr. and predicted a bright future.
We will build back better by doing things in the light of the experiences that we have had, both good and bad. It doesn't matter. No looking back in anger or nostalgia.
Elsewhere in Manila, protesters marched and condemned Marcos' rise to power. They said he pulled it off by whitewashing his family's past. Back in this country, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration now says that new COVID vaccine boosters will have to target the newest Omicron offshoots. Those sub-variants are highly contagious and are fueling a rise in new cases around the world. The FDA says the original vaccines should still be used for people who are getting their first shots. And on Wall Street, stocks closed out another losing month. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 253 points to close at 30,775. The NASDAQ fell 149 points, more than 1%. The S&P 500 gave up 33. For the first half of the year, the Dow is down 15%. The NASDAQ is off 29%. The S&P is off 20%. Still to come on the NewsHour, the president of Lithuania discusses tensions with Russia amid cyber attacks and the war in Ukraine. The Biden administration pledges to make more vaccines available to counter monkeypox infections. An openly gay puppeteer uses his art to bring understanding to his small hometown in Kansas, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, the Russian military withdrew from a key island off Ukraine's coast, easing some of the pressure on Odessa, the country's most important port. That small victory in the south, as the war on the eastern front grinds on, came as NATO leaders concluded a key summit in Madrid. And that's where we find Nick Schifrin again tonight. So, hello, Nick. Now that this summit has ended, tell us what the leaders are saying about Ukraine and how they think the summit went.
President Biden and the other NATO leaders described an alliance revitalized because of Ukraine. And President Biden mentioned that island, Snake Island, which really came to symbolize Ukrainian resolve. The NATO leaders especially celebrated their formal invitation to Sweden and Finland, a country that's been militarily non-aligned for decades, as a sign of alliance unity.
Putin thought he could break the transatlantic alliance. He tried to weaken us. He expected our resolve to fracture, but he's getting exactly what he did not want. He wanted the Finlandization of NATO. He got the NATOization of Finland.
Leaders described the deal between Turkey, Finland, and Sweden that paved the way for that formal invitation as a breakthrough. But Judy, the process for those two countries to join has only just begun and has to go through all 30 NATO parliaments, including the U.S. Congress.
And Nick, President Erdogan talked to the press today. What did he have to say about that episode, the fact that Turkey had blocked Finland and Sweden but then changed its mind?
Yeah, Erdogan said that Sweden and Finland would have to follow through on their promises. And he claimed that they promised to extradite 73 people. And if they didn't, he would not send their admission to NATO to the Turkish parliament. The only problem with that, Judy, is that the document they signed does not cite 73 people to extradite. In fact, it doesn't even guarantee a single extradition, as I challenged Erdogan earlier today.
The agreement that you signed with Finland and Sweden says that Finland and Sweden will address the extradition requests. It does not say that Finland and Sweden will confirm Turkey's extradition request. So are you asking Finland and Sweden to go beyond the language that you've agreed?
Now, you have read the text. The thing is, what is important is what we understand. These 73 people, Sweden gave us a promise we'll extradite them. They will either extradite or not.
Multiple Western officials told me today that Erdogan would continue to extract as many concessions throughout this process as he could. One of them will probably be American F-16s, a deal that President Biden endorsed this afternoon. But the fact is, Judy, until Finland and Sweden give in to his demands, no matter what that text may say or doesn't say, Erdogan can stop their admission to NATO.
Really interesting. And Nick, you had a very full day today. You also spoke with the president of Lithuania. What was the message that he and the other Baltic leaders had today?
Yeah, they arrived here with a real warning, a concern that their countries could be the next Russian target. That's a product of some of their interactions with Russia recently, but also a product of their history. Lithuania was occupied by the Soviet Union, then briefly by Nazi Germany, and then the Soviet Union again for 5 decades until it became independent in 1991. It joined NATO in 2004. And just in the last week, tensions have increased because the country is implementing a ban of goods traveling by rail between mainland Russia and the Russian enclave, Kaliningrad. And so I spoke to President Gitanas Nauseda inside the summit this afternoon. President Nauseda, thank you very much for joining us. When you arrived here, you said this was the last chance to adopt decisions that will be strong enough to stop Russia. Do you believe the decisions NATO has taken today are adequate?
The decisions the NATO summit took, I think, fully meets our expectations. We have to understand that situation is dangerous, the situation is very serious, and we have to take bold, decisive decisions, and I have to say with a certain satisfaction that it was really historic.
NATO will increase the number of troops in your country, in the Baltics, from battalion level, about 1,000, to brigade level, over 3,000. But you've been calling for many more than that. Is the brigade level sufficient?
We have to admit that currently we are not ready. We do not have sufficient infrastructure to accommodate a brigade size battle group or unit. And this is the reason why we have to speed up this process. So far, brigade size is okay for us.
You've said that no part of NATO should have any weakness, but perhaps NATO's most vulnerable part, of course, is the Suwalki Gap, the distance between mainland Russia and the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. How vulnerable is it?
We understand that this is a weak point of our spot of our collective defense. This NATO summit is a green light for preparation in order to be aware of these risks and to deal with this threat adequately.
Last week, Lithuania stopped goods traveling on train between Russia and Belarus and Kaliningrad. Russia's made threats in response to that. How serious do you believe the Russian possibility of responding militarily is?
I don't believe in such scenario, because since 2004 we are NATO member and we have very clear assurances, which were repeated many times also by President Joe Biden, that Article 5 is sacred, rock solid. And, you know, it's not so easy to make harm on Lithuania, because we are quite well prepared. We did our homework, because since the very beginning, since the regaining of our independence, we realized that Russia is long-term threat, and probably we have to prepare.
How do you believe the war in Ukraine should end?
There is no other term. Ukraine should win this war. If it will be not the case, the situation in Europe, situation internationally, will be very complicated and very dangerous. We have to avoid this scenario.
French President Emmanuel Macron has said that the Europeans and the U.S. should avoid humiliating Russia. Is there a Eastern European, Western European divide over how this war should end?
You know, I don't understand this kind of rhetorics, because Russia humiliated itself so much by starting this war. We have to do our best in order to support Ukraine in this war.
Do you fear that some Western European countries could end up pressuring Ukraine to concede some territory in order to find peace?
It would be morally just unacceptable to push Ukraine to make any concessions on the territory.
Do you believe there is pressure on Ukraine to concede territory?
I don't think so.
NATO's united.
I believe in unity which has certain ambitions. And this kind of unity I trust in, and I saw this unity here in Madrid.
Over the last few weeks, Moscow has withheld some natural gas
from Europe. You've worked for years to achieve energy independence from Russia, and of course you've been able to ban natural gas imports recently. Do you believe the rest of the European Union is trying to pursue the same policy that you are, and can they?
I think they will be pressed to pursue the same policy, but we understand very well that it takes time. But if you will not start today, we will not get to the result tomorrow. To do the same as Lithuania did, to let all the illusions about Russia or engagement with Russia.
Senior German officials admitted there was no plan B. There was had been no plans at all.
Unfortunately,
not to use Russian energy before February 24th when Russia
invaded. I remember my conversations with the former Chancellor Angela Merkel, but they decided to go this way. Now this way proved to be wrong.
Late last year, you allowed Taiwan to open a diplomatic office in Lithuania using the title Taiwanese Representative Office. That was the first time any EU member had used the word Taiwanese in the diplomatic office inside the EU. Beijing was furious, launched basically a trade embargo. You've said you weren't consulted on the name change, but overall, why do you believe it's important for Lithuania to support Taiwan?
This is not diplomatic office. This is a trade office we established in Lithuania. The reaction of Chinese authorities was not adequate, I would say. You know, we are the country which tries to respect the principles and values. Sometimes we pay high price for that. But this is our policy towards other countries which are fighting for their freedom. And I think Lithuania is very consistent in this. And sometimes we are example for some larger countries.
President Aceda, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Biden administration has launched a vaccination campaign against monkeypox, making nearly 300,000 shots available in the coming weeks. There are around 350 known cases of the virus in the U.S. and zero deaths so far. But there are concerns about its spread and whether the administration is doing enough. Stephanie Tsai has our look.
Judy, monkeypox is endemic to parts of Central and West Africa, but was found in the U.S. just about 6 weeks ago. It spreads through close contact, which would obviously include sex or kissing. Gay men and other men who have sex with men make up many of the cases that have been identified. And some have posted about their symptoms on TikTok.
It was so painful, I had to go to my doctor and get painkillers just to be able to go to sleep.
A couple of days ago, I woke up with some swollen lymph nodes, and then throughout the day started to become increasingly fatigued, developed some chills, and then started to break out in some weird spots.
For more on all of this, I'm joined by Joseph Osmundson, a microbiologist at New York University and author of the new book, Virology, Essays for the Living, the Dead, and the Small Things in Between. Joe, thanks so much for joining the NewsHour. You know, I was watching some of those TikTok videos, and one of them said he was sharing his monkeypox experience to reduce stigma. I want to start there. Is stigma something that a lot of people are worried about with this?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And of course, this is primarily impacting the queer community right now. It's being spread by our social and sexual networks. And it's a virus that's new, at least in this context, and has really been understudied because of the regions where it's been common for decades. There's so much we don't know. So it's frightening when a new virus comes into our community and our population. And we want to make sure we get the best information out there and also have the best access in our community to what people need. They need tests. They need treatment, and we need vaccine to stop the spread.
All right, let's talk about vaccines for a minute, because the Biden administration this week announced a national vaccination campaign, but it is limited. Only 56,000 doses of a new vaccine, Jynneos, have been made immediately available. There'll be more to come in coming weeks. And then there's another older vaccine, ACAM-200. That's also been approved for use. Can you just break down, Joe, for us who is eligible for these vaccines, and what role does that older vaccine for smallpox, what role does that play in this current outbreak?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's called ACAM 2000. And I'm going to first focus on Jynneos, which is sort of a very modern, really, really safe vaccine. And our argument is that we need to get those doses do no good in a Bethesda storage unit. They need to get into arms as quickly as possible. Those doses do no good in Sweden. We need to get them here as fast as possible. Use that frontline best vaccine that is super safe and start protecting people on the ground. Again, we know what we know. We know this virus is currently popping up mostly but not exclusively in the queer community, in men and other folks who are connected to us by our social and sexual networks. So those are the people we're targeting for our first round of vaccination. But you know, this type of virus that spreads through such close contact, I would be shocked if we don't see this in a wrestling team in Washington State come fall, right? We see these patterns where a disease first emerges or is detected in a small community. But of course, there's much more spread than that that we don't know about yet.
And we should say that the monkeypox is in the smallpox family. So those two vaccines are basically smallpox vaccines. The older vaccine has been known to have more severe side effects for those that are immunocompromised. So your point gets to my next question, which is, does the current public health response to this in the U.S. seem adequate at this point? We're talking about 350 cases or so, but zero deaths.
So the illness is mild by public health definitions in that it isn't seeming to leading to hospitalization or death. But as you saw in the clip, you know, someone I know had monkeypox recently and it hurts. It's very, very unpleasant. And so we have been seeing this disconnect, particularly with the federal response, where we have people in our community who are getting ill and there's vaccines sitting on the shelves. There's drugs in the stockpile. And those drugs, you have to be enrolled through a clinical trial. You know, how many doctors out there in America know how to enroll their patient in a clinical trial and do all the paperwork fast enough to get them access to that drug that means they may not suffer as badly for as long? So we do think that there is an urgency lacking. We expect these things to change. You know, right now in America, no tests, no vaccinations, no drugs. We know there are plans that in a month's time that should shift. And we hope that we continue figuring out not just where this virus is, but the places where it might go and hide people who are outside of access to healthcare, and then not forget that there's a region where this virus is endemic, and people in those regions also deserve access to vaccine, treatment, and care.
Well, there are a lot of questions that remain in this developing story. Joseph Osmundson, a microbiologist at NYU, we appreciate you joining the NewsHour with your insights.
Thank you so much.
Over the past month, Pride celebrations have been held in some of the nation's largest cities to recognize LGBTQ rights. But smaller towns have also been marking the occasion. Special correspondent Kat Wise traveled to rural Kansas, where an artist is trying to foster understanding in his community. Her report is part of our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
On a recent afternoon, a local crowd filled Hidden Trail Brewing in Garden City. They had come out for a special event with lively entertainment not often performed in western Kansas. The Lipstick and Lashes Drag Show was part of a family-friendly Pride Arts Festival called Playcella, which also included rainbow-themed crafts for kids.
Where am I paying?
Resources from a local behavioral health organization.
If you guys have any questions over mental health, we'll try to answer some questions.
Puppet show, 15 minutes!
And a queer-themed puppet show written and performed by the event's organizer, Brett Crandall.
He said you weren't handsome. Well, you are.
He's a 30-year-old puppeteer, actor, writer, and LGBTQIA+ activist. He grew up in a small town called Deerfield, about 15 miles from Garden City.
I can't see 2012, Deerfield, Garden City, doing any of this. It just makes it all the more cool that it did.
Coming of age in a close-knit rural county, home to one of the country's largest beef processing plants, He says he felt different early on.
These are people that I've known a lot of times my whole life. Conversations that I did not have with them because I did not at one point feel safe to come out. Not that I thought that anyone would physically harm me, but maybe that their love had conditions or that it wouldn't be what would make them happy. To actively pop those bubbles is healing for me.
After high school, Crandall quickly made his way to New York City, where he lived for about 10 years. First attending the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and then working as an actor and developing his talents as a puppeteer. He moved back to Kansas in 2019, thinking it would be a brief stop before relocating to Los Angeles. Then his plans changed.
I really wanted to start putting out queer shows in the middle of the country.
Over the last couple of years, he's done just that, working full-time, traveling around the state to put on shows like The Trials of David, a queer biblical puppet play, and Murder at the Wolf Hotel.
I was flattered when thou called me handsome.
I love you, but I am Ondine.
At Playcella, he premiered a new show called Ondine, a queer fairy tale. It's an adaptation of an old French play with a female lead. In this version, a male water sprite, played by Crandall,
oh no, I am caught,
falls in love with a handsome knight named Hans.
No, I thought this for us would end kindly.
But they face some hurdles.
It's a whole different set of rules when you're in the theater or when you're setting an audience that you get to listen and pay attention and let something affect you. So then putting queer stories into that and allowing folks to feel sympathy for queer folks instead of just, you know, the discontent or malice or fear, whatever it is that they've been working with or taught, that was not their fault. You know, that wasn't their idea in the first place.
Last year, he organized the first Kansas Playcella in his hometown, which included a small march through the streets. He proudly walked arm in arm with his partner, Mark Malone. Okay. Among Crandall's biggest supporters now and throughout his life, his parents, Doug and Cindy Crandall, who helped out at the crafts table.
10 years ago, things were much different, especially in rural Kansas. I mean, it was just, you know, you didn't know of anybody, you know, at that point. But today, it's everywhere, and that's a good thing.
The stigma's still there in rural America, for sure. But I think that the kids are more willing to come out at a younger age. Such a relief that they have events like this now.
Gerald Hall, who goes by the drag name Daphne Moonwalker, grew up in a nearby town and says he was often bullied. Now he is trying to use his performance art to help others.
No power on earth can change it.
We want to be the voice for anybody that needs a voice. If you don't feel safe, if you don't feel like you are being included in things, reach out to us. Us as performers, we are here for anybody.
Beyond his activism, Crandall is also focused on arts education in his community and other rural towns. He wrote an opinion piece recently about young people fleeing the plains when they lack opportunities to flourish in the arts.
The kids that grow up here, I hope, don't feel the impulse like I did that they have to leave, that they have to go away. That way, that's the only way they'll find peace for themselves or to be able to get to know themselves. We're just going to keep coming up with new ways, very old ways, of giving that sense of a value to yourself and to our community, that you don't have to go anywhere else. It's all right here.
At the end of the puppet show, Ondine and Hans are finally able to be together. A happy ending he hopes will inspire his audience to find its own. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Garden City, Kansas.
It's heartwarming. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.